You're blind from the facts. Oh, you are, because you're watching that garbage.
You're listening to WGXC, Acra, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM.
Friday, November 5th, the Feelies Rock Band is back in Woodstock performing at the Colony Cafe at 8 p.m. on Friday, November 5th. This is one of many events on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org, and you can even list your own event and have it read on the radio by clicking on the Add an Event button to the top of the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of FET Press in Hudson, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click Donate. Thank you for your support.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers, and doubters. Tourists and locals, all are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
You're listening to Wireless Reconnaissance, Broadcast Surveillance, Transmission Art, and more Saturdays on WGXC 90.7 FM, Creative Community Radio.
This is Tongue in Cheek. I'm here with Sean Leonardo. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Tim.
I wanted to start with that, which was just somebody whistling Vivaldi's Four Seasons, because it plays a particular part in a book that I know has been quite influential to you. Resma Menakem's My Grandmother's Hands.
That's right.
And it comes about at a moment where Menakem is speaking about confrontations between black and brown bodies and white bodies on the street. And he's picking up a moment from this psychologist, Brent Staples, who in the 80s described the ways of pacifying as a black male body, the ways of pacifying white bodies as one passes them on the street. And I'm just going to, I'll just read a short part, unless you want to use your voice for it. But
Sure.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to. After dark, on the Warren-like streets of Brooklyn where I live, I often see a woman who fear the worst from me. They seem to have set their faces on neutral, and with their purse straps strung across their chests, bandolier style, they forge ahead as though bracing themselves against being tackled. Over the years, I've learned to smother the rage I felt at so often being taken for a criminal. On late evening constitutionals, I employ what has proved to be an excellent tension-reducing measure. I whistle melodies from Beethoven and Vivaldi and the more popular classical composers, even Steely New Yorkers hunching toward nighttime destinations seem to relax, and occasionally they even join in the tune. Virtually everybody seems to sense that a mugger wouldn't be warbling bright, sunny selections from Vivaldi's Four Seasons. It is my equivalent of the cowbell that hikers wear when they know they are in bear country.
Thanks. So I thought that might be a nice place to start to talk a little bit about Rezma Menakem's work in relation to
your... Yeah, let's talk about that and apply it specifically to walking.
Great.
You know, I often invite particularly participants in my workshops and the work that I do, performance-based work that I do, to think more specifically about the politics, the baggage of walking, and how even something as simple as a walk is never pure, especially if you are a black and brown body, or as Rezma prefers to call a body of culture. And looking at a walk within the framework of double consciousness, you understand that a walk is not pure because there's always meaning being imposed on your body. And so if you're listening and you're able and mobile, I would invite you to walk in your space, wherever you might be, walk your walk in your body, walk the walk that you would walk on any given day. Walk your regular or maybe normal walk, however you would describe that. And as you're doing that walk, use descriptive language to describe that walk to yourself. What does it look like? What might it look like to someone else? What is the pace? What is the rhythm? What are you doing with your body? Exactly. And now walk your walk, the walk that you would walk to work. Or maybe that's school. And now after a few more steps, walk your walk in your home community. Maybe out in the street in your neighborhood. And by home, I mean wherever and whatever chapter of your life you would identify as home. Maybe it's where you live now. Maybe it's preferably the place you grew up. Maybe it's a place you've only been once. But walk those blocks that you identify at home. And in each of these walks, explore as much of your surroundings as possible. Take in as much information as you can. But be deeply in your body. And again, describe that walk to yourself. Now, instead, after a few more steps, walk the walk that you would walk in a neighborhood or community that was not your own. And as you're doing that, maybe you should start visualizing your surroundings. What time of day is it? What could you be wearing? Again, what is it precisely that your body is doing? Your hands, your shoulders, your neck. What are the steps? What is the rhythm pace of that walk? And now finally, walk the walk that you have walked or would walk or imagine yourself to walk in central booking. Now, for those of you listening that do not know or have had the fortune of not knowing what central booking is, it is the place where you would be waiting for arraignment post-arrest and likely post-spending hours, if not days, in a holding cell. Walk the walk that you would walk as you hold what is about to occur in front of a judge and possibly for your life. Now see that, feel that, and again, describe that to yourself. What did that feel like? What did that look like? And most specifically, what changed between any of those walks? How would you describe the shift to yourself and therefore to someone else? Were those walks still natural or normal? Which one of those walks would you describe to yourself as comfortable? Or anxiety-filled, nervous, fearful? And now think about what it might be, what it might look like for your walk, however comfortable and relaxed, for that same walk to be perceived as suspicious, threatening. Something as simple as a walk is never pure. It's always reliant on the backdrop and the interpretations that the looker brings. Whether it's school, work, home, whether it's central booking or an empty street, the walk that you carry within your body and the meanings that you associate with it, if you were a black and brown body, is never just your own. Something that you would equate as normal, relaxed, chill, comfortable, against another backdrop and in front of another set of eyes, could all of a sudden carry meaning that is not your own. I often try to tie it to this context as essential to my practice and the work that you're about to bring in, Tim. But in real time, for one of the workshops, I would ask, as a culmination of examining each other's walks and the interpretations and meanings that shift as we consider different backdrops and different people looking, I will often bring in some contextual material and ask the group what they might remember from the tragedy of Trayvon Martin's murder. And inevitably, we will get context like place, Florida, time of day, small bits of details like the Skittles, where he might be, where Trayvon was going, if I might so boldly call him by his first name. And then eventually we will get to some of the more crucial data, such as what was actually said to the officers over the phone. And if you paid that much more close attention, then you get to a point where you understand that George Zimmerman called for one reason only, that the individual he was seeing outside of his window through his gates looked suspicious. And now when you strip away all of those details, all that contextual information, you're left with a question. For what we know, what was Trayvon Martin actually doing? He was walking. And I doubt that if Trayvon were alive with us to tell his own story, I doubt he would describe his own walk as suspicious. And so even something as simple as a step has a politic, has meaning. And again, if you're a body of culture, oftentimes that meaning is imposed. And that is the starting point to so much of my work.
Mm.
The ways in which something as simple as a gesture can carry so much loaded meaning. And how do we become more and more attuned to how that meaning impacts every relationship, every exchange, every day.
Mm-hmm. Can I propose, actually, instead of going in the direction that we might think, I mean, to give context of where we will go, there's a show that's currently up until...
Another year or two, actually.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Okay. Which is an installation. I mean, just to give some context
sure.
to the... And for me, my
personal interest, but I think wider interest in your work in straddling many different mediums in the ways that you think about, I would think, sort of facilitating between in drawing and installation now, which these two shows that we'll talk about in a second are specific to, and then in a performative practice, which has its own history of engaging your own body into particular practices, like boxing to a large degree, and also has another branch to it that has to do with facilitating both workshops in non-public scenarios, like is at the heart of assembly, and also workshops that are on public view, which I would certainly want to get into. But so instead of going where we should go, which is maybe to the Mass MoCA exhibition, which is called You Walk.
That's right.
I think just to touch on that last thing you said of the body of culture that is not only embodied by the person whose body it is, but embodied in a larger view of that person. I kind of wanted to pick up on something particular. So there's another exhibition up, or maybe we should call it just a public work that's up, that's something between a document of a set of exercises and its own, in some ways, initiation of it is also facilitating in a certain way for you to walk around the Four Freedoms Monument at the south end of Roosevelt Island. Maybe we could just quickly, if you want to fill in some blanks, we'll just describe that project. But then I wanted to actually just sort of launch into a little exercise that I was thinking about.
I'd love particular that, yeah. to that. But I'm happy to provide more of a contextual backdrop. And so as you said, what is on view, these monumental gestures that are emblazing the facade of Four Freedoms Park, which is a memorial of both FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but also a commemoration of his pivotal speech at the entrance of World War II called the Four Freedoms: freedom of worship, freedom of speech, freedom from want, freedom from fear. And the invitation from the Four Freedoms Park Conservancy was to think about both an instigation.
The invitation to you. You
mean. Correct. Yeah. An instigation of the site, but I would say more specifically, an invitation to think about the ways in which the content of those words captured in the speech might have resonance today. And so my starting point was a rather simple one. What would some of the more vulnerable citizens of our country say about the Four Freedoms? And exploring this methodology of allowing narrative and experience to flow through the body and be conveyed instead by body language rather than spoken language, to see if some other type of truth leaked out. And over the course of really honing in on this methodology and the possibilities of articulation through body language, I've become more and more fixated specifically on the hands and what the hands say and reveal that often betray the words that are leaving a person's mouth. And so to clarify or further illuminate, what you will see are two pairs of hands in gesture. Two very different gestures, and the QR code offer a portal both into hearing musings of the part from the participants on their experience of freedom, whether withheld, barred, or actively stripped away. But as you hear the participants, the hands animate on your phone to subtle movement from one gesture to another.
Okay, let's step back for a second, going back to Rezma Menakem.
Sure.
Because in this book, My Grandmother's Hands, it's structured for three different kinds of readers.
That's right.
Right? The white reader,
the black
body
and brown
of culture. That's
body
right.
of culture,
and
or
then
says,
the police body,
and the police body. Yeah, and importantly, also he's the white body, or he says white body supremacy.
That's right.
Yeah. The way that it moves along, he's going in many different ways between what he calls the lizard brain, right, and then the cognitive brain. I don't remember exactly what he says. Thinking through, or maybe not thinking through, acting through different ways of approaching sort of intergenerational, inherited, embodied forms of racialized trauma.
That's right.
And you were the one that pointed me to this book a couple of months ago. Importantly, throughout, at the end kind of each section, there's something called body practice, mm-hmm. Where there are essentially a set of prompts for embodied exercises. And since I know that that book has been important for you, I wonder, you know, we can go elsewhere into another project if we'd like, but maybe even, for example, with this scenario of the Four Freedoms, I wonder if it helps to compare something to the res mnemonic and embodied practice, the way that those exercises are structured.
Okay.
And what is the difference between the embodied practice and exercises that are done as a part of the workshop,
mm-hmm.
versus the visitor, me today and others today, coming to this place, and what is that? They're kind of watching in on.
That's right. That's right. No, this and that is a really clear distinction, and I would say new both opportunity and challenge in the work in this translation from a performance-based practice to a static one, which again does offer a window into the practice, but situates the visitor as someone that is bearing witness, which is the language I would often use in regards to my two-dimensional work, the drawings that we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
But one of the principles of the methodology, as I've been describing it, is that there are certain experiences, particularly ones that are connected to a traumatic event,
mm-hmm.
that can't possibly be articulated with verbal language.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often, that is due to two prevailing factors, both very common to how the body and mind houses trauma.
Mm-hmm.
One is that we don't recall the details in the same way we would a cohesive memory.
Right.
Quite literally, because it is stored in the brain differently.
Uh-huh.
And the recall, it's often sourced by physical data or sensory, a sensory experience. So it is called up in spurts, mm-hmm. and often without realization. So it could be a scent. It could be a sound.
Mm-hmm.
It could be something spontaneous that all of a sudden calls up the traumatic information and then results in a bodily reaction.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of that is rather understandable in situating oneself in the memory of a traumatic event. It's easier to portray that story as if it were happening to someone else. So it distances the individual from their own telling.
What does?
The story itself.
Of articulating it in words, you mean?
In words, correct. Okay. And we're learning more and more about that recall and the ways in which that is a protective mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
To describe the story as if it were playing out in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so often, especially in my work rooted at Assembly, which is in regards to experiences with the justice system, or preferably the American legal system, what is very evident is that those details that are then shared, the ways in which that story is crafted, is using the same default language that would be imposed on those bodies by the justice system. In other words, you hear a story about criminal,
mm-hmm.
rather than one of an individual, one that centers humanity, and one that is about how that person felt. Mm-hmm. In other words, the very first thing to be removed from one's own perception of that traumatic event is their own subjectivity.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And so what is captured in My Grandmother's Hand and, you know, the practice and methodology of so many of these really brilliant performance-based, somatic-based practitioners is this belief that there's an unlocking and therefore freeing that can only occur in the body when you understand that trauma is quite literally housed in particular places. Mm-hmm. The ways in which we tighten up in the face of confrontation, mm-hmm. or specific sensory events.
Or even imaginations.
Or even imaginations of that might be triggered for by a number of, you know, for yeah. a number of different reasons. Mm-hmm. And that the way or to lead oneself to change toward the person they wish to be in the world, there needs to be an attunement to how your body literally moves through the world, mm-hmm. through space, and what it is that you do that equally diminishes your body by the because of the ways that trauma is taking over that same body.
But this is for, so if we stay with the between four freedoms.
Specifically for the participants.
It's for the participants that correct. we hear in the record, and essentially it's also documented in terms of these gestures in a different way.
And documented in small snippets of web footage that you will, that you can take in right. Via the website.
I want to hold on to, you know, what's the difference in what you're describing of a, let's say, outsider of the participants in the mm-hmm. Between Four Freedoms project coming there, and as you said, and I think in a really fascinating way for some of your other work that I'm thinking about, where you've publicly presented workshops, bearing witness, you know, and for me, there's like you did a... when you were doing I Can't Breathe, these set of workshops that were for self-defense, essentially it's sort of self-defense classes, that there was one that was in Volta in a fair.
That's right.
In a booth, pretty much. And there are the participants, but then there's a much larger circle around of an audience, which is such a strange, you know, version of something, right? Is that suddenly the audience is watching in on something that is particularly focused on embodied experience.
That's right, and therefore participatory.
Right.
And the oddity of that scenario and that setup is very much part of the work. Mm. You know, and
do you usually use the term bearing witness for that relationship?
Yes. Yes, I have. And I would also therefore say strategically I'm always looking for ways in which that outer circle, as you described it, is pulled further and further in to mm-hmm. the participatory action. And some moments they don't even realize that they're being called in as either witnesses or participants. Mm-hmm. So in other words, that there are levels of participation. Mm-hmm. And so for in the case of the project that you brought up, I Can't Breathe, there were specific audience members that, due to their own bravery and willingness, committed to being participants in something they believed to be a self-defense workshop, which then takes a performative turn and therefore shares out mm-hmm. in some unconscious ways, in ways that people haven't even realized, mm-hmm. into something that looks more like a composition. Mm-hmm. And therefore the audience, where they might have more of a safe distance from the participation as participants are locked into action, are all of a sudden being drawn into something that appears to be for them without it being announced in that way.
So let's think about maybe that next to the other exhibition, there an exhibition that's up at Mass MoCA.
You Walk.
You Walk. I'll do my a simple version of describing it. Throughout the museum, there are vinyl of text that are essentially textual prompts for different kinds of embodied experience, sort of very simple triggers. I'll read a couple in a second.
That's great.
As well as not only, you know, these are through the hallways, the sort of like passing space.
One in particular.
There's also these larger decals.
That's right.
Of the windows that are there, but at different times of day or with different weather or, you know, in other scenarios than it probably is outside.
That's
looking
right.
Out the window, right?
That's great. Yeah. That's good. Now, the Mass MoCA invitation, which is similar but different to that of Four Freedoms in regards to a translation of a workshop process,
mm-hmm.
is one in which I, again, through strategy, am attempting to have an individual unlock the possibilities of embodiment and therefore actualizing an exercise without me, without the instruction, simply through the poetics of a textual prompt.
Yeah, let me read. I'm going to read a few of them.
We'll
my mind, of course, just went somewhere else. But I'm trying to stay. With
I'll steer you back. Yeah. I'll steer you back, Tim.
So I'll just read three.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So these are the examples of the textual prompts,
which, for clarity, are placed throughout this hallway, and in relation to where you might be standing, or how, more specifically, you might be standing if you were enacting that same prompt mm-hmm. elsewhere.
You look out the window, wondering how long you will have to wait this time. You walk more closely, unsure of a response, yet acknowledging that the wait of your breath might be enough to cause harm. You look down onto the floor, relishing the lingering impression of the first kiss, but preoccupied with the thought that the second kiss will be your last. So just in those three examples, you mentioned the term imagination in a certain sense, right? There's something that is happening simultaneously, which I think can go back also to the I Can't Breathe, the thing you said, particularly about I Can't Breathe, of it shifting from a workshop.
Instructional space,
mm-hmm. teleological, pedagogical thing into something that's actually storied in itself.
That's right, performative.
Yeah. But with these three that I just read, there's something simultaneous happening. There's, in one sense, the importance of bodily presence.
That's right.
And then, on the other hand, something that's so particularly about imagination.
That's right. And let's stay with that word for a little bit.
Yeah, that's why. But sort of my question is, like, the ways that you think of imagination as playing a key role. I think, especially with work that so many people presuppose it, if it's pedagogical, if it's instructional, there is no imagination, maybe. But I mean, go where you want.
Yeah. I love that framing, because ultimately, while you are not being overtly instructed, you're reading to yourself, to oneself, of this language, which is elusive in some ways,
mm-hmm.
is an invitation to do two things almost simultaneously. And what I find is most important in the crafting of that language is the slippage between the embodiment of one's own memory and the embodiment, or the possibility of embodiment, of an other.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we were to take the third, for example, would you mind reading the third once
sure.
more?
You look down onto the floor, relishing the lingering impression of the first kiss, but preoccupied with the thought that the second kiss will be your last.
Now for you, Tim, and for anyone listening, ideally you would put yourself in this place, and by saying that, I mean attempt to do that with your body. Allow your body to tell you what story should emerge. And as you're there, and I often say, don't overthink it. Allow your mind, allow your body to give yourself that first association and tell yourself that story, as long as it's your own story to tell. Paint the picture of that memory in your mind as your body starts to further and further situate itself back into that place. Who were you with? What has just been said? What did that sound like? What were you wearing? How were those clothes hanging on your body? What was around you? What time of day? Was there a chill in the air? Was it hot? What chapter of your life is this? What precisely are you doing with your body? Now, I've invited you to hang your head down in a state of preoccupation. You've just kissed. But your kiss is your kiss. What did that feel like? And rather than stay with the thoughts that were running through your head at the time, just be in your body and sense what that moment felt like. Now, Tim, what's occurring to you?
My narrative is very, in terms of temperature.
Tell me.
And I wasn't putting, every time that I've felt like it was becoming an image in my mind, then that kind of vanished, and so I came back to it. But it had to do with, you know, a sort of coldness around my lips that then became sort of a heat near my upper cheeks, that then became a tension in my neck, that then became something in my forearms, more of a tingling or something.
Would you equate that tingling with, well, let me ask you, what would you equate the tingling with in terms of, if you were to describe that as an emotive state, what would that be?
Or what can I imagine my body would be doing in a similar scenario?
Or just simply, what word would you use in association with that tingling?
I think maybe a conflict of weight in some ways, that like, because in thinking of an example of the feeling on my forearms, it's sort of like when you try to pick something up with your forearms rather than your hands. And at the same time, somehow there's a sharp edge on it, and it makes your, sort of cuts off your circulation a bit.
So I'm so glad you're going with this here. So that's an important word, conflict, in relation to a kiss. And I think it's even more important that you're locating conflict within your forearms in relation to a kiss. Now, as you've described it, when we pick something up, but we're doing so as it transfers to our forearm because of a particular type of weight, when we relinquish that weight, there lives a tingling in our forearms. Now, how would you describe that in relation to a kiss that may not occur for a second time? Right. Why would that transfer to your forearms? Now, I have some guesses, right? There's what it starts to call up for me is the weight of standing in that one place in that state of preoccupation. Now, if you wouldn't mind, do you, and to push yourself further into the narrative, do you possibly see a person, and is that person a specific person?
No, I don't.
Okay. Is the kiss something distant in time? Or is it an overall experience and therefore not specific to a particular person?
It has all time.
Okay. I think you might say that, right? And so let's stay there for a little bit. Mm-hmm. Let's stay there for a little bit. You know, there's a way in which in a state, and again, I'm going to go back to this idea of like the weight being transferred and the way that the coldness around someone's lips then moves into a heatness in someone's cheeks, and why that might be. Mm. That flush might be the anticipation of that second kiss and how much joy that might bring.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a really lovely feeling. And even in the state of anxiety that causes that tingling in the forearms where you almost are immovable,
mm-hmm.
that still could be a rush of excitement, right? Now, let's pose that against a very different narrative. Again, in the slippage between the embodiment of one's own and the potential embodiment of perceived other.
Mm.
Now, I'm going to take it one step further before offering a narrative in connection to that, to those lines. One that did not exist when writing them, but one which emerged in a workshop mode. I'll push you a little further in saying that that kiss was not with a lover. Instead, that preoccupation that is now tied to a weight has to do with the implication that something is being forced.
Mm.
That distance is not a choice of your own.
Mm-hmm.
The possibilities of not having a third kiss or even the second kiss is not something that you would decide for yourself. Now what's happening for you? Well, let me offer the narrative that emerged in one space as tied to this. I think there's a particular type of kiss that then results in, and I think you all will hopefully understand this, like a heaviness and a heat in one's head, mm-hmm. right? And even that could be that savoring of a kiss with a new love. Or it could be that preoccupation of a kiss with someone that you feel is never going to return.
Mm-hmm.
Now, specifically, I said that this was not a lover, however.
Mm-hmm.
What would it therefore look and feel like to you in the possibility of reading those lines again and embodying those same words and even those same sensations when understanding that translated, that read for another individual who had to leave their family on the border? That kiss was a knowledge, that preoccupation was an understanding that separation was very real.
Mm.
The love of one's parents who were relinquishing touch, care over a child that was attempting to start a new life in the United States. And that distance, therefore, being very palpable, and the unknown associated now with those same sensations, the heat, the tingling, that being a very different kind of weight, a very different kind of anxiety, a very different type of baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I start, this is what I mean, that each time we visit this language, those stories that come to us are very much our own. But in that same text, in between those lines, as captured in certain words, like last, like preoccupation,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
there's a possibility of slipping through into into some other narrative that is not your own, and yet you channeled that story through your body.
This is kind of then very relevant, I think, to what you're saying. That a certain way of talking about that to me we'll do something active again in a second, but of talking about that, for me, has to do with a management of empathy, mm-hmm. right? Which is a very difficult term right now.
Yeah.
But, and it's always a difficult term. You know, it's essentially saying that what, and tell me if this is the way that I'm understanding it, that what I am wearing, let's say, in my body could, or is, not could be, is in some degree a shared experience of something that is of someone else's completely different contextual experience. There's something that is linked there, right? And mirroring each other.
Well said.
To each other.
There's a familiarity in the way in which when we strip away all the details
mm-hmm.
and locate the emotive space that is essential to that story,
mm-hmm.
it looks very similar between your body and mine.
Mm-hmm. So here is a question. Instead of thinking about the imagination of somebody coming to a text on this wall, or the imagination of a participant within the Between Four Freedoms, mm-hmm. or, which is certainly linked, but we haven't gone into it yet, a participant, a police officer that is a part of the set of workshops that were the preparation for your, for or were the leading up to Primitive Games at the Guggenheim in 2018, right?
That's right.
Instead of thinking of those, what if we focus for a moment on your imagination? Because it seems to be such an important part of what, if we can say, facilitation is, especially if we say that facilitation can also be that thing in the middle of the circle that is also watched for its story. You are, not always, but in these cases that we're talking about, the facilitator of these scenarios. There is a particular way that imagination works when you're in live describing an exercise, which I'd love to get into. But I also, and I wonder if this is a helpful way in, I've heard you before be very strict about distinguishing your work at recess through assembly from these other kinds of work that we're talking about, which are in art frames, institutional frames that are focused on art. Not to say that recess is not, but in a very different way.
I love that. So again, very quick, broad strokes in regards to the assembly program, which I co-founded alongside Alison Freeman Weisberg now 7 years ago.
And I'll just interrupt that we are going to do another
That's right.
show together
That's
that
right.
is going to be much more
specific to assembly.
Yeah.
That's right. And one of the peer leaders, who is a young man that, quote unquote, graduated through the cycle that I'm about to describe, which utilizes a curriculum that centers this methodology that I've been describing, but with a very different goal in mind. And I'll get to the question in a very particular way. But we utilize this performance-based visual storytelling series of workshops for youth that have been caught up in the criminal justice system and have since expanded to understand a practice of diversion as anyone who is systemically impacted by numerous systems and the overlapping systems of oppression. But it was founded specifically as an intervention in the court system. And after completion of a 4-week cycle of workshops, again, based on visual storytelling, cases would be closed and records sealed, allowing young people to avoid an adult record. Mm. Now, to your question,
mm-hmm.
there's a distinction in that
for you,
and therefore the way that I describe the work for audiences, let's say,
mm-hmm.
is that the stakes in the room, separate from the courts and the closure of cases, has very much to do with imagination.
Mm.
And the way I would define it or elaborate is that we are talking about communities, individuals, due to these overlapping systems of oppression, the justice system just being one of them, these interlocked systems, which intentionally and systematically strip one from their own imagination. And so to go back to how we started, in the telling of these stories and the ways in which one removes their own subjectivity from their own narrative because it is safer, because it is too painful to articulate those stories through spoken language. What we're also saying is that it's in the telling of a story of criminal that a person has is really incapable of seeing themselves outside of those pre-existing notions of criminality because of the ways in which since an early age they've been told in implicit and explicit ways that they are worthless.
And their body holds that.
And their body holds that. And and so therefore, when it comes to an event like arrest or incarceration, so often a young person will tell that story as if it were matter of fact, as if they were expecting it to arrive. And it goes back to the ways in which seeing oneself out of a predicament and therefore imagining possibility for oneself requires work, requires a retraining, requires a restoration of how one sees themselves in their own humanity. And that is what we're dedicated to. That is what we're invested in.
Yeah.
And now as it moves out into the world, as this methodology moves out into the world, it shares those same principles.
And when you say when it moves out to the world,
in
through
terms
your
of
work.
Either institutions or in other communities, through my work, yes.
Through your work, okay.
The principles remain the same in terms of the possibilities of the method. And therefore, the potential outcomes. But what is different is specifically the investment in relationship that is crucial to a place like Recess. Where in the unlocking and unveiling of what's possible for that person, what is required in that opening is the facilitation and training of not only restoring but owning that imaginative space. And that is uniquely the power of art. To guide someone into seeing themselves as more than or enough, I should say, and therefore owning a different type of future for themselves.
And in a certain way, enough, I'm going to say this in two different ways, but enough to facilitate. As in, that one is a subject enough to, of their own making, to be able to facilitate others to do like.
And therefore, that the that imaginative space, which holds possibility, and I should say, which also holds joy, is something to be held on dearly.
It just reminds me of one thing that I sort of say a lot to myself, I guess more than to other people, but sometimes, is that I always have, or for a couple of years now, I've had trouble with this phrase, or this, you know, cultural idea of cultural ideal of always being a student of life, right? Or of being a which is so attached to kind of a kind of possessive quality of thinking about knowledge and is always, well, I want to keep receiving.
Right.
Where to me, under a certain ways of thinking about teaching, it would be to me more hopeful to actually say, I want to be a teacher my whole life. Or I want to be a facilitator for my whole life.
Yeah, well,
you know,
nice.
Why are we not a world of facilitators rather than a world of students that own property?
Absolutely. And it goes back, you know, alongside an influence like Res Momenican would be Theater of the Oppressed.
Right.
And Paulo Freire and and the belief
Augusto
system.
Boal and
Augusto Boal, yeah. Yes, and the belief system that, you know, students are not simply vessels of knowledge,
exactly,
or to be filled with knowledge,
right,
and that in reciprocal exchange, which is very much a core tenet of the assembly program, that there is as much to be taught as learned.
Well, then I think that we should at least do something else that's more veering towards nonverbal communication, even though we're speaking in order to do it.
That sounds good.
You mentioned one exercise that I think you really wanted to get to. I know that we have two other ones that we were thinking about, the orientation and body position.
I think that might be the one. That might be the one that we want to leave with.
Okay.
Which stems from primitive games.
Okay, great.
And so what we're about to share in this lead out is actually what was in the opening ceremony of that final performance. And so we'll walk through a few different questions, yeah? And what I ask you to do in your space, if you're listening, is to situate yourself in such a way in which you're standing. And every time I ask a question, I'm going to ask you to rotate a quarter turn. Imagine this as a solitary exercise. And so if you answer yes to the statement, you're going to quarter turn left. If you answer no, you will turn right. And so to clarify, if you turn left and therefore, and then the next statement is read and then you turn right and therefore reset, that's fine. Wherever your body needs to go in response to these statements is where it needs to go. Essentially, you are answering with your body and allowing yourself to chart a path of responses by following this circular motion. So again, yes, left, right, no. And I should just also add, be in a place where you feel protected. Be in a place where there's no distraction. And be in a place where you feel that you can answer sincerely. Yes, left, right, no. I believe I am a good person. Yes, left, right, no. I fear for my community. Yes, left, right, no. I feel that I am an American. Yes, left, right, no.
I feel trusted.
Yes, left, right, no. I believe I will be alive in 10 years. Yes, left, right, no.
I believe my mother will be alive in 3 years.
Yes, left, right, no. I've never held a bullet in my hands. Yes, left, right, no. I believe in the right to bear arms. Yes, left, right, no. I have witnessed someone die. Where are you in your circle? Are you aware of how many times you've reset? How many yeses and how many noes? Do you feel you answered truthfully? Were there any answers that surprised you? Does your body correspond or betray your belief systems?